Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
Conversation is the human superpower, right? The reason humans have survived so amazingly as a species is because we have the ability to communicate with each other and share knowledge and coordinate ourselves into societies, move very effectively. But that being said, that does not mean that it is a simple superpower or that it is a superpower we know how to use well every single time. In fact, exactly the opposite. The reason it is a superpower is because it is so complicated. When we are in a conversation, we're literally making dozens to hundreds of choices, oftentimes without even realizing it. But we've evolved, our brains have evolved to be good at communication. And in many ways, the point of this book is to say, everyone is actually a super communicator. Every single person at times has gone into a conversation with a friend and they've known exactly what to say to make that friend feel better. Or they've gone into some meeting and they've known exactly how to pitch their idea so everyone else gets on board. We all know how to be super communicators. We all have instincts for it. But sometimes in modern society, we need to understand certain things to let those instincts come to the surface.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Charles, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So you have a new book out called Super Communicators, which I absolutely loved, all of which we will get into. But there's something that really struck me in the book that I remembered, and that was a mention of your father and the fact that you wished people had asked about it and people rarely did. So yeah. I wanted to start by asking you, what is one of the most important things that you learned from him that have shaped your values and influenced what you've ended up doing with your life?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question. And so I think what you're referencing is that my dad passed away about 5 years ago now. And when I came back from the funeral, I'd mentioned that I had just been to my father's funeral and nobody would ask me about it, right? They would say like, I'm sorry, but nobody asked me questions. And anyone who's had a parent or someone that they love die knows that like, It is very sad, but it's also one of the most interesting and meaningful parts of your life, right? You're like, and so I would have loved for someone to say to me, like, tell me about your dad. What was your dad like? But people feel uncomfortable doing so. And I think that gets at some of the problems with communication. But to answer your question about, my dad was actually great at conversations. He like, and a lot of my interest and passion in asking questions comes from him. He was a trial lawyer. And so a lot of his job was actually asking people questions and going to depositions and trying to figure out what's actually going on. And you have to be somewhat socially comfortable as a lawyer. And so one of the things I learned from him is just, basically that nobody thinks they're a villain, right? Everyone is the hero of the story inside their head. And so if you go into something like a lawsuit where you think I'm the hero and the other guy is, and the other person is the villain, then if you talk to the other person, they're saying, no, I'm the hero and you're the villain. And everyone's right. Everyone's right inside their own head. And so the, question isn't to try and figure out like who's the hero and who's the villain. The question is to figure out like what story is each person telling themselves that the choices that they make seem like the right choices.
The thing I wonder about, particularly when it comes to losing a parent, and I've probably had a handful of guests talk to me about this experience, is navigating the grief of that. Because like I always feel like this is the one thing there's no self-help book for. And I had Frank Ostasevsky here, and I distinctly remember telling him this was like one of my greatest fears, is that I would see one or both of my parents pass before I got married or had kids. And the thing that I remember him saying is, well, don't wait for the big moments in your life. And he said, like, you know, we put all this expectation, and he said, we spend all this time thinking that, you know, we're going to be able to do the work of a lifetime in a moment. But navigating that period after, like when that person is gone, because like, you know, for all of us who have our parents still, they've kind of been there. They're almost like oxygen. Like the idea of them not existing is really hard to grasp, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It's really hard to grasp, and it's really hard to put yourself in that mindset. And let me say two things. The first being the point that you just raised about not waiting for this like one big conversation is really important. I have a friend named Raj Dadada, who's an entrepreneur, and his daughter just went to college. And one of the conversations he had with her before she went to college was to say, look, if you call us when important things happen, but that's the only time you call us when big important things happen, then by definition, you are not going to be calling us very frequently, right? Like big important things don't happen that often. So the key to maintaining a relationship with your parents or with anyone who's kind of, you know, you don't get to see each day is to call when small, unimportant things happen. Just call for 5 minutes and say like, hey, what happened today? Or like, this funny thing occurred, or I thought of a joke, or I thought of you. And that's really, really important to like develop these relationships where we're not waiting for big, meaningful conversations. Because the truth of the matter is, a conversation that's big and meaningful to you might not be to the other person. They might not even remember it. Mm-hmm. As I've become a parent, I've learned this more and more and more that like I think back on conversations I had as a kid where I'm like, that was like a really important conversation. And I now realize those conversations literally happen every week. It's just that when you're a kid, you don't remember most of them. So it's important to get in that habit.
But so that you're going to really recognize them in aggregate, really.
Yeah. I mean, which is how it should be, right? Like a relationship should be have like thousands of points rather than just one. Yeah. But to answer your question about sort of after a parent passes, well, tell me your question because I'm not certain I totally.
Yeah, I guess, you know, like. You mentioned it's been 5 years, and everybody I've ever asked about this says that even after a parent passes away, there's not a day that goes by that you don't actually think about them. Like they're always on your mind. But navigating that period after, I mean, like it sounds like the most heart-wrenching, painful experience to go through as a human being. And yet, like, I know that we all are going to at some point experience that in our lives, regardless of the type of relationship we might have had with a parent. Because even if you had a bad one, that's like a different kind of grief.
Yeah. I don't think it's heart wrenching, to be honest. Like, like, I mean, at least, and I'm sure it is for some people. And so I can only talk about my experience, which was that, like, you know, assuming that your parent has lived a long life, that they've reached an age where death is a natural as opposed to forced outcome. What I found is that often, or a lot about the period afterwards, is a celebration of who this person was. Like you get to remember all of the great things about them, and you see all these other people who come to you and they tell you how much they loved this person. And it's really powerful. And then the other thing that happens is that your relationship with them continues. Like they might be gone, but your relationship with your parent matures and changes and grows. Because now you get to think about them as the choices they make as you make those same choices, right? As you get older, you get to realize like, oh, when I was 15 and I was like a punk, this is what my dad was going through. And this is how he was thinking about it. So the relationship with your parent doesn't end simply because they're gone. It does for them, but for you, it continues to grow and mature. And in some ways, that's actually wonderful.
Speaking of the relationship with your parent, how have how did your parents end up influencing the way that you parent your own children?
Like hugely, probably in ways that I don't even realize. And let me ask, do you have kids?
I don't. I mean, I have a 1-year-old nephew, so like it's been really fascinating. He's the closest thing I have to a kid, and I'm going to see him tonight after a month.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. But, you know, because I like the joke that I have with friends, you know, we always say like it's like parents always like, you know, kids are always like, I'm never going to do what you just did when I have kids. And like I have friends will tell me it's like, you know, ask them, do you find yourself echoing things that your parents would say to you
yeah.
that you found really annoying? And suddenly you're like, wait a minute, I'm doing exactly what I said I wouldn't do.
Right. Which is probably a sign of maturity. So I think two things happens. And anyone who's listening who has kids, I would imagine that this is similar for them. The first thing that happens is when you have kids, particularly young kids, you start remembering all these things about your own life and your own parents that you had basically forgotten, right? There's like almost this like somatic memory that comes back from taking care of like an infant or taking care of a 2-year-old where you're like, oh my gosh, now I remember my mom used to do this thing every Christmas and I have not thought of that for 20 or 30 years, but now I want to do that with my 2-year-old. So that's really wonderful is that you almost get to rediscover your own childhood. But then the second thing that happens is that, yeah, there's a bunch of stuff that like, that didn't seem important at the time that suddenly starts to seem very, very important because you understand how powerful it was for you. So I mentioned my dad is a lawyer. I grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he had cases all over New Mexico. So he would like drive to like, you know, towns that were 4 or 5 hours away to take a deposition. And sometimes I would drive with him, basically to keep him company. And this is obviously before the days of like podcasts and stuff like that. And so, you know, in rural New Mexico doesn't have the best radio stations. So basically to pass the time, we would just talk and we talked about everything. And we talked about stuff that like there is, you know, we talked about religion and money and politics and family, all this stuff that is really, really meaningful that you don't talk about normally just because you don't have the time or there's other distractions. Mm. And so one of the things that I try and do with my kids, we just took a trip back to New Mexico and then to Arizona, which is where my wife's parents live. And we had these kind of long road trips as part of this trip. And so I told them they had to put away their phones and we turn off the radio and we just had to talk because if you just talk, interesting things come up. And that's definitely something I learned from my dad is literally if you have nothing else to talk about, you start talking about things that matter. And those are the conversations that hopefully shape my kids and that they hopefully remember.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
It's funny when you said the thing about, like, you know, re-experiencing your childhood or remembering what your parents were like. It reminded me of a story my sister told me recently. You know, my parents, because they live close by, whenever she needs help, they'll come by. And they'll literally find any excuse to go and see their grandson. And they're much nicer to him than they were to us.
Right.
But this was like the funniest thing. My sister said, hey, you'll appreciate this. She said, my nephew made he's one, so you can imagine the degree of, like, artistic, you know, like, prowess he has. He made basically literally like a handprint at daycare. I think he just put his hand in some paint and brought it. And keep in mind, like, my sister and I were straight A students. Nobody hung report cards on the fridge. Like, we brought home, like, almost all of our artwork. And my mom took this, like, little handprint. She's like, oh my God. She's like, we have to get this framed. And she was like, we brought home hundreds of pieces of art, like lots of, like, you know, straight A report cards. And she acts like this guy is the next Picasso with a handprint, which there was just a funny moment of thinking, like, exactly what you're talking about. It's like, whoa. So she's in a lot of ways experiencing exactly what you mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and what's funny is that, like, the other thing that happens, as you know, from watching your sibling go through this, when you have a kid, you're just exhausted. Like, I'm absolutely certain your parents would have loved to have saved all of the art that you made as a kid, but probably they're like, if I can just get them into bed, like, in a halfway decent hour and clean with their teeth brushed, then, like, I've accomplished so much for today. And then by the time you're a grandparent, you're like, yeah, I don't have to put up with any of the, like, hard work. I'm just going to do all the fun stuff.
Well, it's funny you say that, because my sister, basically, when she was, I think, one or two, she would go into my parents' room and she wouldn't cry. My dad would be like, no, go back to your bed. And he would fall asleep. And an hour and a half later, he'd wake up and she'd just be there with her arms crossed, like, staring.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my nephew did the same thing to her. He had, like, a good 3 hours standoff with her where she kept looking at the nanny hem. She's, like, texting my dad. And my dad's like, well, guess what? What goes around comes around. And she caved. She was like, he won 11. Like, she was like, he's not crying. He's just standing there in his crib. He won't go to sleep.
Yeah, it is really, really fun to have kids, and it is super exhausting.
Yeah, I bet. Well, funny enough, that I think makes a perfect segue to actually talking about the book. So what was the impetus for this as the follow-up to your previous books? To write a book about communication?
Yeah, a couple of things happened. And like, the focus of it is, you know, the science of conversations and the science of connection. Like, why do some conversations go so well and we feel so connected to people afterwards? And then at other times, sometimes with the same people, we really want to connect with them and things kind of go astray. And I basically was asking this question because it happens in my life all the time. I was at the New York Times and they had promoted me to become a manager. And I thought I would be a great manager because, like, you know, I've had lots of bosses and I have an MBA. And it turns out I was good at all the logistical stuff, but I was terrible at the communication part. Like I just like people would come to me with problems and I would completely misanalyze what they were trying to tell me or how to respond to them in a way that showed them that I had heard them. And then I had this experience at home that happened frequently, which I think is pretty common, which is I would come home from like a long day of work and, you know, I'd be like in a bad mood and I'd start talking to my wife and telling her like, you know, my boss, you know, is a jerk and my colleagues don't understand me or appreciate me. And my wife would basically answer with like some pretty good advice. She would say something like, you know, why don't you take your boss to lunch and you guys can get to know each other a little bit better. And instead of hearing what she was saying and hearing this good advice for what it was, I would get even more upset. I'd be like, why aren't you supporting me? I want you to have my side on this. And, you know, like I want you to be outraged on my behalf. And I couldn't, and this would happen again and again and again, right? It happens in every relationship. And so when I started getting interested in trying to understand how communication works, I'd talk to experts, I would tell them about this situation. And what they would say is like, well, the first thing you have to understand is that we think of a discussion as being one thing, right? Like it usually has, we think of it as having one topic, but actually every discussion is made up of multiple different kinds of conversations. And most of those conversations fall into one of three buckets. There's practical conversations, right? Where we have to make a decision together. There's emotional conversations where the goal is not to make a decision, not to solve a problem, but rather to share how we feel and hear other people reflect on that. And then there's social conversations, which is what where we're talking about how we relate to other people and they relate to us, how we believe other people see us. And so what was happening with my wife is that it's pretty simple. Like I was coming in and I was having an emotional conversation. I was basically saying to her, I want you to hear how I feel and I want you to reflect, acknowledge those feelings. But she was having a practical conversation. She was saying, let's solve the problem together. And both of us were right. But because we were having different kinds of conversations at the same time, we both failed to hear each other. We both failed to connect. And so the thing that I carried from this was there's this big insight, which within psychology is actually known as the matching principle, which is the first step in any conversation is figuring out what kind of conversation is happening and then matching each other. Yeah. And that's kind of what the book is about teaching people to recognize different kinds of conversations and then the skills you need to connect with each other.
I think what's striking to me is that you and your wife were both unaware of the fact that you were having two different types of conversations.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Probably not because it's intentional, but like, how many people even have the awareness to know, like, I wouldn't think about this consciously, because, you know, like you actually talk about sort of the conversational mindsets and role in communication. You say the first mindset, this is the decision making mindsets associated with what's this really about conversation. And it's active whenever we're thinking about practical matters, as you mentioned, or making choices or analyzing plans. The second mindset, the emotional mindset, emerges when we discuss how do we feel and draws on neural structures, the nucleus accumbens, the amygdala and the hippocampus that help shape our beliefs, emotions, and memories. And the third conversational mindset, the social mindset, emerges when we discuss our relationships, how we are seen by others and see ourselves and our social identities. These are the who we are discussion. But the thing is that like you and your wife mismatch, like most people probably have no idea that they're mismatched and are completely not aware of it. Like I wouldn't even be aware of this. And I have conversations for a living.
Yeah, no, this happens all the time. In fact, there's been studies that show that if you look at the average conversation, about 80% of conversations involve miscommunications where one person says something and they believe that the other person has heard them and the other person has heard something completely different. Right? This happens all the time. This is why when you have a meeting, you follow up after the meeting with a memo saying, here's what we decided. Because if you just asked people, they would all say we had decided different things or different aspects of things, or they would describe it in different ways.
Yeah.
Conversation is the human superpower, right? The reason humans have survived so amazingly as a species is because we have the ability to communicate with each other and share knowledge and coordinate ourselves into societies, move very effectively. Conversation and communication is our superpower.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, that does not mean that it is a simple superpower or that it is a superpower we know how to use well every single time. In fact, exactly the opposite. The reason it's a superpower is because it is so complicated. When we are in a conversation, we're literally making dozens to hundreds of choices, oftentimes without even realizing it. We're trying to decide whether we should be formal or casual, whether we should speak quickly or slowly. We're trying to gauge how the other person is responding to see if they're hearing us or they're not hearing us. Mm-hmm. But we've evolved, our brains have evolved to be good at communication. And in many ways, the point of this book is to say everyone is actually a super communicator. Every single person at times has gone into a conversation with a friend and they've known exactly what to say to make that friend feel better. Or they've gone into some meeting and they've known exactly how to pitch their idea so everyone else gets on board. We all know how to be super communicators. We all have instincts for it. But sometimes in modern society, we need to understand certain things to let those instincts come to the surface. And that's kind of what the book's about.
Well, you say that super communicators know how to evoke synchronization by encouraging people to match how they're communicating. And I think that, you know, you just kind of identified. If I were to just analyze our conversation in the last 20 minutes, I would say we were in an emotional conversation talking about your dad, but now we're in a practical one talking about your book.
Absolutely.
Is that accurate?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And let's get even deeper. So you started with a question about my dad, right? Knowing that my dad had passed away, which is an invitation for me to join you in an emotional conversation. And I responded emotionally. I talked about kind of how I felt that after my dad's funeral, like what I was feeling. And then I think you very, very adeptly matched my emotionality and we had an emotional conversation. And then we entered into a more practical conversation, talking about how the ideas in the book apply to what we've just been discussing about. And you invited me again by asking a question about the book. You invited me to move into a different kind of conversation with you. Mm-hmm. And we can't see each other right now, but if we could, and if we had enough machines to measure it, what we would see is that as we're communicating with each other, we begin to synchronize. Our eyes would start dilating at the same rate, even though we're in different places. Our heartbeats would start to match each other, as would our breath patterns. Most importantly, the activity within our brains would begin to synchronize. I would begin to think like you, and you would begin to think like me, which is what communication is, right? I'm describing to you an emotion or an idea, and you're experiencing to some degree that same emotion or that same idea. And our brains become what's known within psychology and neurology as neurally entrained. That's communication. That's connection. And so to your point, the reason that we're able to do this is because we're both good communicators. And most importantly, because you're asking questions. And questions are the most powerful tool for learning what kind of conversation someone else wants to have and for inviting them to align with you.
So this is actually out of morbid curiosity based on everything that you just said. When we started this, I had you turn off video.
Yeah.
How do you think that affects the dynamic based on the research you've done here?
I think it depends on the kind of conversation. There's some situations where being able to see another person is really, really helpful because there's a lot of nonverbal signaling that occurs. But for a conversation like this where it's being recorded, oftentimes I think turning off the video is really helpful because rather than allowing me to rely on visual signals, my brain realizes I need to infuse my voice with many more signals. I need to make my voice as broad a channel of communication as possible. And so when I do interviews, for instance, recorded interviews, I often ask people to turn off their video because I want them to rely on their voice to tell me, to transmit to me what they're trying to communicate rather than relying on expressions that the listener can't see.
Well, one other aspect of this you talk about is this idea of matching. You say that simply mirroring another person's gestures or moods or tone of voice doesn't forge a real connection. Giving into someone else's desires and preoccupations doesn't work either. Those aren't real conversations. They're dueling monologues. Instead, we have to learn to distinguish a decision-making conversation from an emotional conversation from a social conversation. We need to understand which kinds of questions and vulnerabilities are powerful and how to make our own feelings more visible and easier to read. We need to prove to others that we're listening closely. So for example, if I had tried to match your tone and your inflection points, that would be incredibly disingenuous and it wouldn't sound like me. But how do we actually do this? Like
how do
without
we do it,
it
right.
coming across like, you know, like some sort of sociopath?
Well, okay. So let me ask you a question. So, think first, like if you've had a very bad day, who's the one person you know you can call that would just make you feel better to talk to them? Is there someone who pops into your head when I ask that?
Yeah. I mean, my dad can be hit or miss on this kind of stuff, but you know, he's usually pretty good about it. Probably my friend Matt would be the person to call.
Okay. So Matt, so let's take Matt for a second. So, so is Matt like the smartest or the funniest friend you have? Is he like the most like charismatic or outgoing person you know?
I mean, he'd get pissed off if I say no, but no.
No, right, right. Yeah, and actually, that's a good thing. That's why he's a super communicator, particularly for you. So let me ask you, what is it that Matt does that makes you feel so good when you talk to him?
I figured it out. He listens. He doesn't give advice.
Oh, interesting. And how do you know that he's listening?
Well, I mean, I lived with him for 2 years, so it's really hard to verbalize this. It's almost like we have, you know, sort of so the way we're described is we're like yin and yang. Like he's the eternal optimist. I'm the practical person. So like when he comes to me with any idea, I'll basically be like, all right, here are the holes you need to poke in it before you go and do this. But when I have something, he'll be like, hey, this is how you're going to make $1 million off of this. And I'm like, okay, well, let's, you know, come down to earth here. So we kind of balance each other out in that way, is the way I see it. Like,
and that's exactly like what most people say. Something like that is what people say when you ask them, like, who's the super communicator in their life? Now, my guess is that tell me if I'm getting this wrong. My guess is if I was to watch you and Matt talk, here's some things that I would notice. I would notice that you're a super communicator for Matt the same way that he is for you. He would come to you with his problems. Number two, I bet you when you guys are talking to each other, you ask each other a lot of questions. And studies show actually people who habitually super communicate, they ask 10 to 20 times as many questions as the average person. But we oftentimes don't notice it because they're not like interrogation questions. They're things like, huh, what do you think about that? Or that's interesting. Tell me more about that. Or what happened next? They're these small questions that invite the other person to reveal something or to expose something. And then the other thing that I would see is that you and Matt laugh with each other a lot.
Yeah.
Not because either of you are necessarily saying things that are that funny. In fact, 80% of the laughter that occurs in most people's lives is not in response to something that's funny. It's not in response to a formal attempt at humor. Laughter is how we show each other that we want to connect, that we're paying attention. And when Matt asks you questions, they're probably follow-up questions. They're probably questions that ask you about something, and then he comes back and he asks you about your answer. He's proving to you that he's listening. Now, when it's more formal, when it's not with someone who's like a best friend who we have this real ease with, when we're, for instance, in a situation of conflict, we're in a fight with someone or we're debating something, there's ways to do this that are a little bit more structured. And one of my favorites is this thing called looping for understanding. And it's a pretty simple method, and it's the technique that has been shown again and again and again to be the most important technique you can use in a conflict conversation. And what it is it's a way to prove to the other person that you are listening to them. And what you do is it's just three steps. The first thing is you ask them a question, listen to their response. Then in your own words, step two, you summarize what they just told you, right? Not repeat it, not mimic it, but rather explain what you heard. And most people know to do this, but then it's step three is the really important part. Step three is after summarizing what they just said, ask them if you got it right. And what studies show is that if you do this, the other person believes you are listening. The same thing you said about Matt, right? Matt is really good at listening to you. But in addition, he's probably also really good at proving to you that he's listening. And whether it's something formal like looping for understanding, or whether it's just a habit we get into with friends, that proving that we're listening, that's the thing that makes us feel close to each other.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
You know, when I read that, I felt like you were describing my interview process, like the way that I interview. I literally did, because I thought to myself, I'm like, wait a minute. Because as I told you before, like, I don't have any questions planned in advance, which means that I have to literally listen to everything you've just said. And based on, you know, what you've just said about looping for understanding, I think what we're talking about here is, in some ways, like we're having a learning conversation as well. It sounds like the sense I'm getting, you know, you say in a learning conversation, our goal is to understand what's going on inside others' heads and to share what's happening within our own. A learning conversation nudges us to pay better attention, listen more closely, speak more openly, express what might otherwise go unsaid. It elicits alignment by convincing everyone that we all want to genuinely understand one another and by revealing ways to connect. And, you know, based on what you said about looping for understanding, I feel like this learning conversation kind of overlaps with all the three different kinds of mindsets, depending on the type of conversation. Like, isn't every conversation on some level a learning conversation?
Yeah, it should be. It should be. That's the goal. The goal is to basically use a conversation as an opportunity to learn about the other person and to help them learn about you. And that might seem like a pretty simplistic thing to say, but think about how frequently we don't do that, right? Sometimes we go into conversations where our goal is to beat the other person. Like, I want them to agree with me. And so I'm just going to like pummel them with my arguments or my evidence until they agree. Or sometimes the conversation is about going in and just trying to like avoid talking about the thing that's bothering everyone and just prove to everyone that it's not going to, that issue doesn't exist anymore, even though we all know that it does. Mm-hmm. A learning conversation says, look, you can walk away from this conversation disagreeing with each other. You can walk away from this conversation hating each other. You can walk away from this conversation without resolving any issues or without having a good time. But as long as you try to learn what the other person is actually thinking and feeling, and you give them an opportunity to learn what you are thinking and feeling, then the conversation is a success. That is the definition. You have connected with that person. And that's the gold standard to go for. So then the question becomes, like, how do we do that, right? Like, how do we ask these questions that allow us to connect? And there's kind of two answers there. The first is we should ask very specific kinds of questions. We should ask deep questions. And this word deep question is a little, this phrase is a little misleading because it makes it sound like we're like asking people about like their deepest memories. But actually, a deep question is just something that invites us to talk about our values or our beliefs or our experiences. So it can be as simple as saying to someone like, you know, what do you do for a living? And when they say, I'm a lawyer, to say, oh, did you always want to be a lawyer? Do you love being a lawyer? Is it, what's the best part of being a lawyer? Those three questions are all deep questions, even though they don't seem intrusive. They don't seem overly personal. But what they do is they invite the other person to tell me about their values or their beliefs or their experiences in a way that allows them to expose something that's a little bit authentic, a little bit vulnerable. And then if I reply by sharing something authentic or vulnerable about myself, it is impossible for us not to feel closer to each other. Our brains are actually hardwired to feel closer when we've both exchanged something that is vulnerable or authentic.
Now you know why I start the show with the questions that I do. You've just verbalized it.
No, I think it's really, really smart. And I think what you're doing is you're inviting the other person to be vulnerable, and then you're sharing something vulnerable about yourself. And it sets the temperature of the conversation. And so a big part of this process of making that connection is asking deep questions, training yourself just to look for deep questions, which is pretty easy to do once you're looking for them. And then when somebody responds with something authentic, giving them something authentic back in return.
Let's dive deeper into the who we are conversation. And I want to approach it from two angles. One that's just absolutely ridiculous, which is a personal thing, and one that's actually real. So let's start with the ridiculous one first.
Yeah,
right? I'll tell you the backstory, right? So you're talking about the role of self-awareness and social identity. So my mom and I butt heads over all sorts of stupid things because she's like super OCD and, you know, our house is cleaner than Buckingham Palace. So one morning I'm like loading the dishwasher, and I've mentioned this before on the show, and she's annoyed that I didn't put the stupid cups in the proper way, and it turns into like this ridiculous, just annoying blowout. So I go to the therapist's office, and he's like, hey, you know, we've been talking about this for 6 months. You realize that, you know, he said, you can either keep going to battle with your mom about this stupid dishwasher or just accept that that's how it's going to be. And I come back and my dad's like, I could have saved you $50 and told you that. So this honestly, I thought to myself, I'm like, okay, well, what can Charles teach me about how to be effective at fighting with my mom, which seems, because she's somebody I'm like, wait a minute, there is no dialogue with her. It's like my way or not. Like,
so right.
Talk to me, because, and I'm sure I'm not the only, this is like an example of your fights with your wife, probably kind of similar.
Well, okay.
So talk to me about that.
Can I ask you a couple? Let me ask a couple of questions. The first is to figure out, like, does anyone actually want a conversation? So do you want an actual conversation with your mom? And do you think your mom wants a conversation with you? Or is it that you both just want the other person to be like, you're right, I give up, I give in?
I think it's the latter.
Yeah. Okay.
And much like, I don't think she's interested in having a conversation about what, if I went to her and decided to like have this lengthy conversation about why the way you load the dishwasher doesn't matter. And the oatmeal actually did this hilarious cartoon about it, which is where it's like, you don't load it like Jesus on Adderall, your dishwashing, you know, privileges have been provoked. But the funny thing is, it's such an utterly pointless thing that doesn't matter. And probably you're right. Neither of us would actually be willing. But the thing is, one of the reasons I want to talk about the social identity is like, I think that immediately when I would go into that conversation, my bias kicks in. I'm like, she's going to lose her shit over something, even a small thing. And I already am thinking that based on historical evidence. And that's a cognitive bias at work.
Okay, so here's the next question. What do you think this fight is actually about? It's clearly not about how you put the dishes in the dishwasher, right? Like, you do not care how you, if she, but there's something else going on there. What's the deeper conversation you're actually having that this is some proxy for?
You just said it, that I don't care, because this is like a version of put the cap on the toothpaste, which I've told you to do 1,000 times. You know, same thing. This is, my mom's like, some girl's going to marry you and think we didn't raise you properly because you don't do all these things. Like, these are, but it ultimately is, you're right, that you don't care thing. And then I'm thinking about it, and I'm like, you're right. I kind of don't give a shit about any of these things.
So can I propose something, and you can tell me if you think this is right or wrong. Is it possible that what actually is going on here is that your mom is saying to you, as a mom, the way that I evaluate whether I'm a good mom is whether I've taught you some basic stuff about life. And when I look at you load the dishwasher, and I think about the fact that you're not married yet, and I want you to get married, and like, part of me is a little bit paranoid. Maybe the reason you're not married is because like, women look at how you load the dishwasher, and like, of course, this is not true, but as a mom, I'm thinking to myself, like, look, if I can't get him to load the dishwasher correctly, maybe there's all this other stuff that I haven't done as a good mom. And him loading the dishwasher correctly is actually a signal to me that I am a good mom. And from your perspective, the conversation you're having is, mom, I'm an adult and I don't want you telling me how to do stupid things. Like, you should give me the freedom to let me load the dishwasher the way that I want to load the dishwasher. And so actually, maybe what's happening here is that you guys are having two different conversations. You're having a conversation about freedom, which is basically a practical conversation, right? I'm an adult. I should be able to load this conversation however I want. What we're really talking about is whether I have the freedom to make this choice. Your mom is having an emotional conversation, and that conversation is, I want to feel like I'm a good mom. I want you to tell me that I'm a good mom. That's an emotional conversation. And when you load that dishwasher the wrong way and you act like you won't take my advice, what you're actually doing is you're telling me that, like, I don't get the emotional reward that I want to know that I raised you right. Is that possible?
It's a pretty interesting way of looking at it. I've never thought about it from that perspective before.
Let me ask one more question. Let's say your mom comes in, she yells at you how you're loading the dishwasher, and you just said to her, and you said, mom, I want you to know, you are a great mom, and I love you so much, and I've learned so much from you. And then you turned and you continue loading the dishwasher the same way you always did. What do you think she would do?
She would probably ask if I had taken any drugs recently. Chances are that would be the first question. She'd be like, I think that would be so, create so much cognitive dissonance that she'd be like, wait, who are you?
Which might not be a terrible thing.
No, not at all.
But probably at that point, the dishwasher would become less of an issue in her galaxy of things she has to worry about.
Yeah.
I'm diagnosing the situation correctly, but it usually, when we have dumb fights like this, it's because we are actually having different kinds of conversations, or we are caring at that moment about different things. Yeah. And the other person doesn't understand what we're actually trying to get at.
Well, let's bring this back to a more serious example that, you know, people would actually find useful. But I'm guessing the mom fighting with mom example is probably more relatable. You wrote about the gun control advocates and those who were, you know, people who are arms bearers and who all were, you know, pro-gun. And I thought that was such an interesting example of the role of social identities and how they came out. But then, if I remember correctly, you said, like, when everything started to unfold online, it kind of went back to hell.
Yes, that's exactly. So just to set it up for folks. So there was this group of civic advocacy groups that wanted to do an experiment. So what they did is they reached out across the nation and they found about, about 24 people who were gun control advocates who, like, you know, showed up for marches. They lobbied state legislatures and the exact same number of people who were gun rights owners advocates. So these are people who belong to the NRA. They have leadership roles in the NRA within their state. They're on the other side of lobbying on gun bills. And they brought them all together. And, you know, usually when you bring people together for something like this, the goal is to like have a meeting of the minds, or here's what we agree to, that, you know, we agree to disagree. That's not the goal of this group at all. What this group wanted to do is they didn't care if people agreed with each other. They just wanted to see if they could convince people to have a civil conversation where they actually exchanged ideas. And in order to do that, they had this theory that they're going to train them in some specific communication skills. One of them was that looping for understanding that I mentioned, sort of proving to someone that you're listening to them. But others were to ask certain kinds of questions, particularly questions that elicit emotional responses. And that doesn't mean that you have to ask people about emotions, but it means that you can ask people questions like, you know, is there a memory that you have about guns that informs why you're pro-gun or anti-gun? And almost everybody would answer that question. Everybody had some memory. And those memories oftentimes were emotional memories. They could be positive emotions, like, I remember my dad taking me out hunting when we were kids, and this is a way that we bonded with each other, which was hard in other settings. Or they could be negative emotions. One woman that I wrote about, she actually was in school in Las Vegas, and there was a school shooting, and one of her teachers was killed. And so what the researchers found is that when you get people talking about their experiences or their beliefs or their values in a personal way, in an emotional way, then what happens is that other people, even people who disagree with them ideologically, they recognize those emotions and they sympathize. So I might not be a fan of guns, but when you tell me that this is how you bonded with your dad and that this is what hunting means to you, is this chance to get to know your father who is distant and aloof at other times, it's impossible for me not to sympathize with that. Everyone knows what that feels like to want to break through to their parent. Or when someone says, like, you know, the reason I'm anti-gun is because I saw a teacher of mine get killed, that produces sympathy from everyone, because we know how traumatic that can be to see someone that you love and admire suddenly taken from you. And so even when we disagree with each other on practical issues, even when in that what's this really about conversation, the practical mindset conversation, even if we disagree with each other, that doesn't mean we can't align in other kinds of conversations, like an emotional conversation. And once we do align in an emotional conversation, it makes those disagreements, it doesn't solve them, but it makes them feel less divisive. We can at least try to understand what each other is saying, even if we don't agree with each other. Now, you had asked about going online, and you're exactly right. So they do this thing in person. They have this weekend-long training and conversations for all these folks in Washington, D.C. And then they send everyone home, and they say, look, we're going to continue the conversation on this private Facebook group. And they invite other people to come and join the private Facebook group, who, again, are gun advocates or gun control, gun rights advocates or gun control advocates. And once it goes online, it like falls apart immediately. Like literally within like minutes, they're calling each other jackbooted Nazis. And so one of the things that researchers are trying to figure out is like, why does this fall apart so much online? And the answer is that the way we communicate online has to be a little bit different than the way we communicate offline, whether it's something like this, like a remote conversation, or whether it's face to face. Because we have spent literally thousands and thousands of years learning how to communicate with our voice. We've also spent thousands and thousands of years learning how to communicate by written letter, for instance, right? Where people tend to edit their letters before they send them out. We've only been communicating online since the 1980s. And so a lot of the small little signals that we use in letters or in face-to-face conversation, they're missing from online. So when someone is, for instance, being ironic, it's very hard to detect that irony when it's like, you know, a text that someone shoots off, or a post that they write within minutes and hit send. And so one of the big lessons, and study after study backs this up, is that when we are communicating online, we need to overemphasize all of the etiquette things that normally we would do in a conversation. We need to avoid irony. We need to be more polite than we might usually be. We need to show that we've heard and listened more than we might in a voice conversation. But that when we do that, actually online conversations get much, much better.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I think about, you know, emails that I've received from people who are pissed off because some guest said something on the podcast, and it makes me think about how I would respond to that now, having, you know, like, heard what you just said. But there's another part of this that really struck me, and this was sort of the core ideas behind the Who We Are conversation, was these sort of foundational ideas where, like, drawing out conversational partners' multiple identities, trying to ensure that everyone is at an equal footing, and you say don't offer unsolicited advice or trumpet your wealth or connections. Finally, look for similarities that already exist. I think it was the don't ask for unsolicited advice which struck me most, because I feel like, particularly on the internet, to tie it back,
yeah, like,
I feel like there's just like an abundance of unsolicited advice. Like, I remember I have literally had people who hear me say something about dating or relationships here on the show, and somebody will like come and basically try to give me advice, like in my Facebook message, and I'm like, or even get me to hire them to like be my dating coach. And I'm like, wait a minute, I didn't ask for any of this advice. And there's certain times, you know, in life where like something painful happens to somebody, the cruelest thing you can do in that moment is to give them advice. Cause like, I remember having a conversation with a friend, and you know, she was a coach, and I was like, okay, listen, I need you to stop being a coach and just shut up and listen to me whine about this girl who dumped. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
The thing I think I'm particularly interested in out of these three is this notion of multiple identities.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. So let's go back to that. So we walk into a room, and here's the identities we've been assigned. I'm against guns and you're for guns. Now, if the conversation works correctly, by the time we leave, there's going to be dozens of identities to complement that. So I'm against guns, but I'm also a father. I'm someone who is a son who has memories of my own father. I'm someone who works with other kids and tries to teach them responsibility by taking them hunting. Or I'm against guns, but I'm also a mom who's worried about my own kids. Or I'm someone who tries to build stronger communities. Or I'm a politician within my community for safer policies. When you think about these like identity-based disputes that we have, right? Oftentimes when we disagree with each other over identity issues, it's because we see each other as just one identity. You're black and I'm white. You're a man, I'm a woman. You're pro-gun, I'm anti-gun. But of course, the truth of the matter is that like everyone is made up of dozens and dozens of identities. And the more that we draw out those other identities, the more that we give people an opportunity, we ask questions about those other identities, the more we complexify the situation, the harder it is for us to allow prejudice or stereotypes or whatever it is into a conversation that block us from understanding each other. So if I know that you are a podcast host and that you are someone who's single but wants to find someone to spend your life with, and that you're someone who has, you know, cares about your parents a lot, but you have a difficult relationship with your mom, and you're someone who like sometimes can have conversations with your dad that's really meaningful and sometimes a little hit or miss. As you become a real person, as you become someone who embodies the multiple identities that you possess, it makes it impossible for me to stick you in a box and say, oh, I shouldn't bother to listen to this guy because he's just an X. Yeah. In a lot of ways, like the whole goal of conversations is to see the whole person, because inevitably we will find things that we have in common that we can build on.
I had no idea you were a surfer, for example.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And even if it turned out you and I disagreed about everything else on earth, the fact that we're both surfers means that we have some common ground that we can start building. We can learn, we can figure out a way to connect.
Well, it's funny because, you know, this multiple identity thing is, you know, as you were describing it, it made me think about sort of, I described an interview process once, like I'd, you know, written a blog post on interviewing and what it is. And I said, like, the way I see it, people are onions. And as an interviewer, your job is to keep peeling layers until you get to the core. And each one of those layers is like an identity you're talking about.
Yeah.
And that's actually why, like, often when I read pitches, I almost never look at the headline. I'm always like, what's the really weird sort of thing in here? Like, we had this guy, Wiley McGraw. And literally one thing that entire pitch got me, I was like, this guy was a competitive bull rider. I'm like, that is why I'm saying yes. Yeah, like, I was like, I don't, that's the like headline of this guy as a performance coach wasn't what got me. It was, wait a minute, he's a bull rider. That is actually really interesting. Because publicists hate my guts because I'm like, you know, they're like, what do you look for? I'm like, I could not tell you that because it's just pure curiosity to the point where we baked it into the contact form. It's like, tell us something we're not going to know about you from your LinkedIn profile or, you know, your bio on your website, because this literally will determine potentially whether we say yes or no.
Yeah. And I think that's a really smart way of doing it. And I think that you have an instinct to try and figure out, like, I really like that the onion analogy. And the thing is that, like, very often, and this is why online is so hard, is that online does push us into seeing people as one dimensional, right? Like you post something about, like, you love the Eagles, and I'm going to assume that that's your entire identity, that you like love the Eagles and that there's nothing else interesting about you. And I think the Eagles are the worst. I like the Jets. And so I'm going to respond that you're a moron. Like, that's one of the hard things. Now think about, like, in real life, if you met that person and they're like, I love the Eagles, they're the best. And then you're like, okay, but I also see you're here with your kids and we're at this restaurant because we both live in this town. Like, all these other identities become much more apparent in real life, and yet they're hidden online unless we learn to look for them or unless we invite people to share them.
Yeah.
And that's really important. Particularly, you know, one of the chapters in the book is about Netflix and this controversy that they had when, after one of their top executives used the N-word in a meeting, and he got fired, but the whole company was kind of like torn apart by this internal debate over whether it was appropriate he should get fired or not. And you know, and we've seen this over the last couple of years, a lot of companies grappling with ideological or political issues or identity issues in ways that can really tear the organization apart. And one of the ways that Netflix dealt with this is they brought in someone who's an expert in this, who basically had meetings where she said, the goal of this meeting is to talk about all of the identities that we have. Because whether you are black or white, you have a racial identity, and you have a gender identity, and you have a family identity, and you have a work identity. And if we put all those identities on the table, it's going to be impossible for you to see each other as one-dimensional people. It's going to be impossible for you to see each other as these stereotypes that can be dismissed. Yeah. And that's exactly what happened. It doesn't mean that everyone agreed with each other. It doesn't mean that everyone felt the same way, but it did mean that everyone felt understood. And once you feel understood, then you can agree to live with differences.
So, in the interest of time, like, it's funny because I was going to ask you how I could take this and apply it to my dating life, but my listeners have heard enough of me soliciting my guests for dating advice using their ideas. So we won't do that. I'll just use AI to like dissect that. It got me thinking about like our political discourse and, you know, when we're the United States, I think like just based on, you know, what you see on the news and many of the conversations even I've had with people who actually have worked in our government. You know, I mean, to the point where Ezra Klein literally wrote that book, Why We're Divided.
Yeah.
So talk to me about like what it takes, what it's going to take to get these ideas to become just mainstream in terms of the way we deal with political discourse and the kinds of effects this could have on things like misinformation.
Well, I think the number one thing is that people have to want to have conversations, right? Like we were talking about you and your mom, whether you guys actually wanted a conversation or she just wanted you to say yes.
Yeah.
And there's sometimes so that we don't want to have conversations, and that's fine, right? Like when I ask my kids, like, can you put away your dishes? I'm not actually asking them to have a conversation with me about putting away their dishes. I'm just being polite and saying, put away your dishes. So it's okay to not want to have conversations sometimes, but let's say it's a situation where we genuinely do want to have a conversation. In a conversation, as we discussed before, it's a learning conversation. The goal is to understand the other side, not to convince the other side that they're wrong. And so particularly when it comes to political conversations, if we go into discussions, debates with others about politics, if we say to ourselves, look, my goal here is to understand why this person feels the way they do. Not to convince them that I'm right, not to convince them that they're wrong, but just to understand why they're saying what they're saying. Then two things are going to happen. First of all, you're probably going to succeed at that. You're probably going to learn something about why they see the world they do. But number two, when you show them that you want to listen to them and you want to learn from them, they will want to listen and learn from you in return. And inevitably, when that happens, we tend to become a little bit more sympathetic to the other side. That doesn't mean we change our minds. It doesn't mean that I'm going to vote Republican, even though I'm a Democrat. What it does mean is that oftentimes I'm going to understand that you agree with 80% of what Republicans say, but 20% of it you think is crazy. And by the way, I agree with 80% of what Democrats say, and 20% of it I think is crazy. And once we understand that, now we can start saying, okay, look, actually, there's a bunch of stuff that we have in common. And so when it comes to politics, I think the number one most important thing is to say, I'm going to go into this conversation. I want to understand why the other person sees the world the way that they do. Not convince them that my way is better, not convince them that their way is wrong, but just understand. And inevitably, when you do that, you end up walking away with something richer, where you both understand the world a little bit more accurately.
Well, for our sake, I hope you're planning on attending the next, you know, Congress session and handing out your book, just, you know, to senators and congressmen, like, just, you know, like, hey, here. Yeah, you guys.
I'm not sure
this.
They want to have conversations.
Yeah, well, which is like, it's kind of crazy, right? Because isn't the whole point of these things to make decisions? And like, I remember watching, I think it was during COVID when they were trying to figure out the second, you know, stimulus thing. And I was like, a bunch of 5-year-olds could have come to a conclusion faster than this.
Yes. Yes. There's a lot of stuff like that, right? There's a lot of times when you look at it and you're saying like, look, But I think in situations like that, like the truth of the matter is that in some places, getting elected means not having conversations.
Yeah, fair enough.
Right? Like what the constituents want is they want someone who's going to go like kick ass and like, you know, say ridiculous things and stand up for their, I mean, that's kind of the whole Trump campaign strategy, right? Is to appeal to voters who don't want to have conversations. They want to win. They want to be victorious. And so I understand why it happens. But I also understand that there was a time in this country. I mean, look, the truth of the matter is America is a country that was built on conversations, right? We literally had a constitutional convention, which was a bunch of people debating and discussing and sharing ideas until we came up with a constitution. And ever since then, the reason why we've been a special country is because we managed to contain so many different identities and beliefs and values and somehow all still work together, usually through conversation. And in the last couple of years, we have forgotten how to have these conversations, but they are desperately important. And so the more that we as citizens, as residents of this country, the more that we have those conversations and model that good behavior, hopefully that means our leaders see that they should as well.
Well, in the interest of time, I think this is a beautiful place to wrap up. So I have one last question, which is how we finish all of our interviews. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Okay, I'm going to answer, but then I want to ask you the same question. I think it's authenticity. I think at the end of the day, you know, I'm 48 years old. And the thing that I've noticed is that the older I get, the more I value and admire people who are authentic. And sometimes that authenticity does not mean that they agree with me and it's not my jam, right? Like I live in Santa Cruz, California. There's a bunch of people here who basically just live to surf. Like they don't have interesting jobs. They don't care about their work. They just want to be amazing surfers. And that's not a choice that I make, right? My work is much more important to me. But the fact that they are so authentic about it and that they commit to that in such a meaningful way makes them really interesting to me. And so I think the thing that makes someone amazing and unmistakable and remarkable is when they know who they are and they're willing to invest in that person. But now let me ask you, what's the answer for you for that question? Well,
you know that when you write a book called Unmistakable, you actually have to define this, right? So, well, I defined it for me. It was this idea that is something so, I mean, it kind of expands on the authenticity idea, but it's the idea that something is so distinctive that nobody could have done it but you, and it's immediately recognized as something that you did. Where you're not trying to be better than anybody. You're trying to be the only person who can do what you do.
Yeah.
Thereby making your competition irrelevant.
Yeah. I think that's a beautiful definition. And I think that is authenticity, right? Is to say like, the standard that I'm judging myself against is a standard in my head. And yeah. And therefore it's the most meaningful one.
Well, like I said, I think that that makes a beautiful place to wrap up what could probably turn into a 3.5 hour conversation very easily based on this. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, the book, and everything else you're up to?
Absolutely. And thanks for having me on. If you just Google me, Charles Duhigg, I have a website, charlesduhigg.com. If you email me, my email address is charles@duhigg.com. And I read every single email I get and I respond to all reader emails. So please don't hesitate to drop me a note. And yeah, I would love to hear from folks, and I'd love to hear what they've found in conversations is meaningful and important, and what tools they've cultivated to be able to connect with other people.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run FutureTools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of Lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving, no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here, like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The Four Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.